A Wednesday Evening Lenten Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 19, 1997, entitled, Not So Cocky, Peter. The texts for the sermon are from Mark 8, verse 27 through chapter 9, verse 1, and chapter 14, verses 22 through 31, and 66 through 72. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
We had a television camera here Sunday, very unobtrusively. It was the NBC affiliate from Milwaukee. And there was a very nice young man who had become familiar with our situation and our controversy and had prepared himself very well, and the two of us engaged in an interesting conversation as he interviewed me. At one point in the conversation, he said, well, he said, do you really feel like you're a winner? And of course, I said to him, you know, it really was not about winning and losing. He said, well, I understand that. And it's not about winning and losing in our pursuit of a deeper understanding of the gospel and the claim of God upon us. And yet, it seems as though there is something in us, and particularly in our institutional religious forms and structures, that is always trying to bring closure, to have the last and final word, to have things wrapped up in a neat package, and to have a claim of absoluteness. It is everywhere apparent in the history of the church. The history of the church is replete with excommunications and repudiations and charges and countercharges. And we never seem to come to understand that it is not finally for us to have the truth wrapped up in a neat little package. That's what I want to say this evening as we look at the story of Peter. Peter, who was ebullient and lovable and frustrating. I have to smile when I think about the fact that the Roman Catholic Church names Peter the first pope, the papal office being the office which, just as recently as the 19th century, the Church has said that when the Bishop of Rome speaks from the teaching chair, the bishop is inerrant, infallible, cannot be a mistake, cannot make a mistake. Well, in pointing to Peter as the first pope, they've done a good job because he's an excellent model which denies the very claim of the office. For if there was anybody who ran through the Gospels as a rambling wreck, it was Peter. And the Scriptures are filled with stories, stories with which we can identify and from which we can draw lessons for our own life. And the lesson from Peter tonight is that we ought not to be too cocky, either about our knowledge or about our commitment. The Lenten season is a good time for a heavy dose of humility. And that's what I would simply hold before you this evening. The gospel lesson begins in the middle of Mark's gospel, which really marks a transition in that gospel. Now Jesus will be on his way to Jerusalem. The latter part of the Gospel of Mark is the Passion story, and the encounter at Caesarea Philippi is a hinge moment in which Jesus finally says to his disciples, "Whom do you say that I am?" And Peter, the spokesman for the group, says, "You are the Christ," or "You are the Messiah." It's very interesting because we usually read that encounter from the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew had Mark in front of him, but Matthew greatly enhanced the story. In Mark, Jesus never takes to his own lips the word Messiah except before the high priest at the last moment. And in this answer in Mark's gospel, Jesus sternly warns them not to mention the fact. It's rather interesting that Matthew took Mark and wrote the lavish praise that Jesus heaped on Peter. Obviously, Matthew had another intention, which was to establish the leadership of Peter in that infant church, along about another decade after Mark had been written. But in Mark's gospel, there is none of that, just simply a stern warning, don't mention this. And then, the beginning to prepare the disciples for the fact that there was trouble ahead, to which Peter responds with the same word, rebuke, as Jesus rebuked the disciples, saying, "Don't mention it." Now, Peter rebukes Jesus, if you can believe it, and says, "Don't talk that way. It won't come to you. It won't happen to you." And we have an echo from the temptation stories as we hear Jesus say again, as he said in the wilderness, "Get behind me, Satan." A pretty stern word. "Peter, you don't discern the things of God. You're thinking as a human. You're thinking humanly. And you are an obstruction to me. I'm having enough trouble keeping my eye on the course as it is, and I don't need that kind of encouragement." But it was sort of like water off a duck's back, because the next time we hear at table Jesus sharing the bread and the cup, and then speaking about the fact that soon they will all desert him. And again, Peter says, "Don't even think of it. If I have to go and die with you, I would never deny you." And then, of course, I skipped over to the aftermath of the trial at the high priest. Peter had followed afar off. He was hiding in the shadows. But he was discovered. And three times over, denied strongly that he even knew the man. And at the cock crow, it all washes over him. And he breaks down, the gospel literally says. Luke's account has a moment when, if you can imagine, perhaps Jesus moving from one place to another catches Peter's eye. Jesus looked at Peter, and it says Peter went out and wept bitterly. I think we've probably all had our moments of weeping bitterly because we came up short in regard to the things of which we were so sure, and we failed where we never thought we would have been vulnerable. And in that moment when it all rushes over us, literally or figuratively, we weep bitterly because it is a tough, tough lesson to learn that our knowledge is very limited and our commitment is very fragile. Our knowledge is limited, and as a matter of fact, our knowledge is not so terribly important, even though the church seems to be so hung up on dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I had a lunch discussion this week talking about the age of the earth and about the evolutionary process and about the difficulty of harmonizing the Genesis account with all of that. And I said to a very dear friend of mine, who is very brilliant and very conservative, I said, how do you square that? And he said, I really don't know. And I could have kissed him. The coach of the Pistons, you know, kissed Terry Mills the other night after making another three-pointer to the amazement of Terry Mills. But I could have kissed my friend. He said, I really don't know. That is so refreshing. We don't know so much, do we? And if it's true of the beginning, isn't it true of the end? I was going up and down the shelves of Barnes and Noble a couple weeks ago, and there I see still on the bookshelves is Hal Lindsey, who wrote The Late Great Planet Earth some years ago, sold thousands of copies. There was the whole map, just exactly what the future is going to hold and how it's going to unravel. And as a matter of fact, we don't know. If we're honest, we have asked the church, we've asked people to prepare for the coming of Jesus, for His imminent return, for the last 2,000 years. And as a matter of fact, it just is not working according to that apocalyptic scheme that was everywhere in the air in the first century. And yet still, there are claims made, and as we approach the year 2000, we're going to hear more of them. The scenario of the end. And I would echo what my good friend said about the beginning. I really don't know. And in terms of what the Christian mission should be and what our task is as Christian people. It was all very clear in those early days when the Gospels were being written in that first century under the first blush, that explosion of the Christian mission. But to continue as a Christian church, to talk about the evangelization of the world, is simply ridiculous. It's not honest. It is a claim far beyond our understanding. For we don't know what God has in mind. You see, I think that's why Jesus rebuked Peter so sharply in the beginning. He technically had the right answer, Messiah. But he didn't at all understand what that involved. Jesus didn't necessarily ever claim that title for himself. And you know, Jesus didn't really know what it involved either. If Jesus knew what lay before him, beyond the fact that there was trouble ahead, then the passion story takes on aspects of a charade. To me, the wonder of Jesus is that he pushed forward, not knowing, but simply being obedient to his vision and trusting God. And that, seems to me, is a formula for a Lenten Christian. Not claiming to know so much, because there is a deep mystery that surrounds God and a deep mystery that surrounds our own lives. We don't know so much. And we intend to be faithful. But the word of Paul is a good word. Let the one who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. It boils down, it seems to me, to a proper humility. That's what the Lenten season invites us to with each returning spring. A proper humility before the mystery of God. The acknowledgement of the limits of our knowledge and the fragility of our commitment. Our vulnerability at any moment to fall, to fail, to be in that tragic situation of a Peter who weeps because he has discovered that he's not all he thought he was. That is a Lenten invitation. Humility, obedience, trust, and then finally, a resting in the God of all grace. I think Luke was trying to signal that grace when he had that eye contact between Jesus and Peter. It was not a look. I cannot conceive of Jesus looking as I might have, saying with his eyes, "I told you so." With his eyes, I'm quite sure he said, "I love you, Peter, and it will be all right." And John's Gospel, at the end of the Gospel, gives us that touching scene of Jesus and Peter after Easter, where he says, "Peter, do you love me?" Three times over. And Peter said, "Yes, I love you." And Jesus says, "Then get on with it. Feed my sheep." Not so cocky, Peter. Just humbly resting in the God of all mercy. Thank God that that's the way God is. Because we are the way Peter was.